Hello, everybody. I'm Michel Nashan of Wholesome Wave, and I'm the guest editor this week on foodrepublic.com. So log in to the political section of Food Republic for fun, facts, great meaty stuff, everything delicious, everything real, everything ready to go. Foodrepublic.com. Thanks, Heritage Radio Network.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Hello, hello. Can you hear us, Jack? Yeah? All right. This is a live recording of Unfiltered. This is your co-host, Aaron Fitzpatrick.
And Brian DeMarco. I'm not even sure I can hear myself in the... here we go. Oh, there we go.
There we go. Yeah, January 10th, kicking off the second week of the new year here at the studio.
Kicking off the new year for the show in general, I mean.
Yeah, in general. Yeah, 2012, this is the first show, so let it be the first of many to come. And
as dictated by our executive producer, and we have, you know, we have happily for our first show back, we have Miss Lucy Stylus, co-producer, anchor extraordinaire.
Yep, business partner as well. So you can get on the mic anytime, Lou, if you want to jump on. And I have to say, I'm very excited, kind of jumping up in my chair right now that Roberta's just got the Green Flash beer and the IPA Green Flash on draft. So that was a welcome addition to start off the show.
Yeah. Indeed, yeah. I love that we always start the wine show with beer.
Mm-hmm.
It warms us up.
It's the right thing to clear the palate after lunch, that's for sure.
So is there a wine opener in this house? I can't believe I didn't bring one. I brought wine, though.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure Jack has one. But in the meantime, I know you brought a couple wines over there, so we'll dig into those in the second half of the show. But what's news in your world?
Well, all right. So it's funny because we have no guests today except ourselves, which I think is enough ammunition for three shows. But let's see, holidays. Let's start about, you know, what the drinkings and comings and goings. I had a very privileged evening the Friday before New Year's to go to La Bernardine for a vintage champagne dinner, care of Acker Merrill.
Excelente.
And I sat with Mr. Capon and a few of the angry 12 angry men. And we drank everything from, you know, 55 Gosse to the highlight, I think, was the three vintages of the Bollinger Old Vines, Ville Française, which is basically there's that one plot of land that's pre-phylloxera vines. And we did 79, 80, and 81.
Wow.
And so 1980.
That was all the Bolly?
All the Bali.
Huh.
But it was the... What's your...
79.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cool. So say that again, the three vintages, 79?
79, 80, 80
and 81.
And it's interesting because in 1980, there was not a lot of quality vintage champagne made, if any, which I think is a pretty broad statement, I'll admit, but I haven't tasted a lot of 1980 that was blowing my dress up.
Yeah.
And this 1980 was fabulous.
Nice.
I mean, fabulous. And the other standouts were, I mean, I think part of the premise was, I don't know if you know, his auction handle is Big Boy, but Rob Rosania was...
oh, yes, I've met him before.
You know, he's a particular kind of personality, but when he brings that kind of largesse, I have to bow to him. Probably the single biggest collector of champagne in this country. And he brought purposely not Krug, not Moët / DP,
right,
and none of the big houses.
Okay,
and we drank the Gosse's, You know, we drank a lot of the off the beaten path champagnes, the Philippinat, Claude Agassiz, 1955.
I love Philippinat, actually.
Yeah, such a nice champagne.
Yeah. I was in Champagne in September. We visited the Philippinat house, and it was one of these houses that I just hadn't seen much. I think that they might have had export issues, or at least distributor issues in the New York market, and are sort of trying to regroup. And
I'm actually trying to pitch that. Yes.
Oh, excellent.
I'm very excited to.
I was very impressed by their quality and not familiar with the range of wines that we tasted there. So it was a real treat.
Yeah, they're quality people. Actually, a friend of our mutual friend of ours, Julian Faulkner, one of his parents' friends are connected to that family, the Philippinat family. And I had a meeting with one of the shareholders in their home. We were in Lyon, and they broke out the champagne that, you know, this had on hand. And we were talking and discussing the brand. And this is like 3 years ago. And he said to me, we've had a lot of trouble in New York. And, you know, I know we're not the biggest brand, but, you know, we have, you know, hundreds of years of history, and we should be able to find a place.
Awesome.
And then I was like, yes, these champagnes are fabulous. And at the time, I didn't really think much about it because we were off to Remy Bernard, and we did a couple of private tastings at some bigger houses, which we won't mention. But it seemed that it all rested on marketing dollars. Mm-hmm. It all rested on the ability of to market the product. Whereas in, you know, some of our quests when we do small producers and stuff, when you did the Jura stuff and when you've done stuff for
Cahors,
it's about, you know, finding the small producer and sort of championing their cause. And, you know, they have no money, but that's the whole point of it. And bringing them to the United States is sort of a labor of love for both parties.
Right.
Whereas champagne, you know, if you're not going to have the clout or the muscle to make your way into the market, it's almost a fool's errand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it really becomes a pay to play situation with champagne. But
well, I would say watch out then for Philippinat, because they might become making a little re-entry or comeback into the market, I'd say.
One would hope, yeah.
They were also really popular for, I think, in Asia for the past couple of years with their non-dosage. So a really, really dry style of wine that seemingly every house that we visited in Champagne was producing, based on some sort of popular trend for the non-dosage. It's not my favorite of the market. It's certainly interesting, and I think it goes well with a range of different foods. But theirs seemingly was doing really well. And to follow up, because we're talking about holidays and Champagne, Lucy and I had a 2002 Bollinger on New Year's Eve with a dozen oysters from the South Old Fish Market, which I have to give little Charlie, the proprietor of that market, a shout out, because they were delicious and local and a pretty magnificent pairing with that O2 Bali, which was something we had actually talked about with Lisa Granick a couple
That's
shows
right.
back
That's
as
right.
a standout for the champagne tasting that was held at the Plaza. Central Park. What's the Plaza? Yeah, the Plaza.
The Plaza Hotel, yeah.
Yep.
Well, I think that the DP has been the first to come out with a very strong O2 vintage, and they did the Andy Warhol series with the different bottles, a green bottle and yellow bottle, and the labels. It's pretty cool. I've tasted that vintage. I think it's pretty fresh and interesting. It's funny because, you know, the O2 Burgundy vintage was all the rage about 5 or 6 years ago, and it was just like between 99 and 2002. Those are incredible Burgundy vintages. And if you think about the proximity of Champagne, it's so close, and you would think that vintage would be good, and now you're finding out that it is. And it takes a bit longer to
assess after
being
in bottle for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like the prices are abating at all. So we will probably see champagne continue to creep up in price.
Mm-hmm.
But all that's doing is allowing, you know, the other producers of sparkling to bring their products to market in a more value driven segment. So what else? What was your meal, Miss Lucy? What did you guys have for?
Well, that was our cocktail hour. That was No, you're gonna hand over the mic. Yeah, bring it, Lou.
The rest of the meal was quite good as well. Actually, we went to a friend's house and of a farmer who I work with that I help process chickens, and they made a pretty awesome fried chicken.
And with their birds.
Yeah, with their birds, of course. That was rockin'. Then we had a really good mac and cheese. It was total Southern style. And then good size, nice homemade sourdough breads. And then we ended with a bomb banana pudding that I made, I must say. It was up to par.
Yeah.
It was a lovely meal. Unfortunately, we didn't have more of the O2 Bali.
No,
that's
all right. We kept that at home, and then we showed up at the party, and you know, we drank some local sparklings from Shin Estates and from Sparkling Point, which were good later in the evening.
Yeah, but the Sparkling Point is not bad.
Yeah,
that's it's a guy from Rodier, so yeah, there's a little bit of history with his stuff. It's good.
Yeah, so Sparkling Point is in Quchog, and it's a French winemaker who joined the team 2 years ago. Who was previously at Roeder, and before then in Champagne. So he has certainly the pedigree to make good sparkling wine, and he's doing that out in the North Fork. So,
what brings a Champagne producer to the North Fork?
That's a very good question. Well, he was before that. He was in California, so he was still domestic. He was at Roeder Estate in California, you know,
so love and money, that's about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was New Year's Eve. There were a couple other good bottles throughout the holidays as well. My dad opened a 97 Hess Cabernet Sauvignon, which I'm surprised he even knew he still had. That was nice with a little beef bourguignon.
Is that what you had?
Yes, that is what we had. Mm-hmm. Yep. That was the day after Christmas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I made, as you know, a Monty's ham, and we haven't talked since.
And
I sliced and diced it and put the cloves in, and whole house smelled wonderful. And we had ham for 5 days afterwards, and it was like, okay, enough ham. And but for New Year's Eve, I made beef Wellington.
Oh, cool.
And old school. And so the funny thing was, is I had been looking at Whole Foods, which is, as you don't know now, but I'm about to tell you, is Whole Foods now is below my apartment. So that makes for very
I actually did know that. You shared that news last time I saw you.
Well, very expensive, like, you know, local shopping now. It's like, you know, and you walk out with four items, it's $100. But they didn't have any puff pastry. And they had phyllo dough, which I got in an argument with one of my guests that, you know, we could use phyllo dough to make this. And I said, it's impossible. It's not going to taste right. It's too much. It's too difficult to work with, and it's basically like the worst Greek, you know, desserts. I'm sure I'll get slaughtered for this, but like, unless you put a pound of sugar and honey on phyllo dough, it doesn't taste good.
It's like cardboard.
Right, and anytime I've had, you know, spanakopita or spinach pie, whatever, it's only the filling that you like. It's like having cardboard hold together something yummy.
That's a little harsh. I've had some good phyllo bites in my day, but
not the prepackaged.
The prepackaged kind, which unfortunately my aunt on Christmas Day decided to pop those in the oven for hors d'oeuvres before dinner, and I'm like, no, thank you. That's okay.
Yeah, they'll never know.
Or you take one and you just sort of lightly, you know, stuff it underneath your cocktail napkin. You know, that move.
But I did. I have a shout out for the Pepperidge Farm prepackaged,
because that's what you use with the welly.
Yeah, and it was redonk.
Nice.
So I, you know, laid it out, beat it down a little bit, cooked a $50 cut of filet mignon, total tenderloin.
Did you use foie on it?
I used
a pate of sorts,
yeah, which I also rolled flat, and I made a mushroom duxelle, which is you know, five shallots and two packs of mushrooms, and cook it down till it's just gorgeous. In fact, I remember from culinary school that I had to make mushroom duxelle like it was my job.
Oh yeah.
So I had to make that a lot. So I was like, you know, went into blindfold mode and just made that like on the side, and I seared off the beef, the filet mignon, and around, and then I actually I let it cool, and then carefully took off the twine that was holding the meat together, and then I basically got a ton of parchment paper, And I rolled that. I rolled that bitch up with mushrooms and pate, and got it nice and round, and then put it inside the filo dough and rolled that up and like trimmed the edges, and then put some nice cross hatchery on top.
Oh yeah,
and then threw it in the oven for about 45 minutes on 350. And then at the end, cranked it up to about 425. You get like nice toasty.
Golden.
And it came out. It was like definitely ooze and ahs. Awesome. People were like losing their minds.
Yeah.
Did you buy the Pepperidge Farm at your local deli?
I went, no. First of all, they only had it at the Associated. Whole Foods does not carry any puff pastry.
No, of course not.
They carry nothing.
No.
And so, but the beautiful thing was is that the Associated, the predominantly gentrified Associated market in my neighborhood,
that is fighting
the Whole Foods,
right,
has every brand that you grew up
good
with.
Good for them.
Yeah. As they should not discriminate.
Every brand you grew up with, and then they have three kinds of puff pastry. And
so, what did you pop with this? What did you drink?
Wines. We started with a Steininger.
Gruner?
No, it was Riesling.
Oh, cool.
The Riesling was amazing. Everyone thought it was champagne. Which I guess just shows that.
It was a sect or
it was sect, yeah. But it was sect, and no one knew, and no one cared because they were pounding it.
Right.
And then went to
Pierre.
I did Billy Carsamon and Pierre Peters and
awesome.
Those are the champs. And then the red wine came out, and it was some Burgundy and a little Bordeaux. And then we actually busted out one of the Leo Hillinger. The Hill One, which was actually a crowd pleaser because at the end, you have all this sort of like food wines, and then this is just a hedonistic sort of like fruit wine,
right?
Which kind of worked out well. And
we've had Leo's wines on the show before.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah. I mean,
he's a familiar name.
Well, so going back to Austria in terms of mindset, I'm leaving Saturday. To go to Austria.
Well. Yeah. I did not know this.
So I'm telling you on the air that you need to find someone to sit in for me next Tuesday.
I see. Okay.
So you can't get mad at me. But I leave the 14th and I'm back the 18th. So,
okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Just a notes and letters comment. Thanks.
Yeah, notes and letters. But so tell me, what else did you, what were your sides? What were your sides, guys?
That night?
Yeah, any sides.
Any sides.
Stood out, because I love sides.
Well, let's see. There were some black-eyed peas. Hmm. There was some slaw, which was put on this meacock's pork were braising.
We're talking New Year's here.
Yeah, we're talking New Year's. Yeah, Christmas, beef bourguignon needs no sides.
Noodles,
yeah, exactly. But no, we actually, on the topic of food, Lucy and I got a drop off from one of our faithful customers this week of about four different cuts of mousse.
I'm a little touch and go with it, but kind of excited to see what it is.
Yeah, I mean, curious to hear your opinion on it, Brian, if you've ever had mousse before. Obviously, yeah. It is a beautiful animal and one that we're not sure it's
okay to
really indulge in.
But for a drop off of mousse, we're gonna indulge.
It was already killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you didn't hit it with your car.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. That was so now we have said that as well.
Yeah. So now we have ground meat. We have a sirloin.
We have a strip and a strip, roast.
And a strip and a roast.
So let's start from the
Let's start
with the butt.
The butt, yeah.
I would cube up that roast and I would make a dobe. Like a stew.
Take a French stew
and just make it nice and let that thing cook half a day.
Yeah, it's going to need to cook down big time.
And then the strip.
Mousse au poivre?
We were advised to do a pepper steak.
Yeah,
I was going to say that.
Oh, no, we have a tenderloin. That's the other cut.
I would use a tenderloin. It's going to be a little ropey. So I would maybe marinate something.
Yeah.
And then throw it, do a flash grill. Sear it off and then throw it in the oven and let it cook and then slice it pretty thin. And God knows what,
Yeah. Well, when you get back from Austria, frolicking in Austrian fields, we will have a report for you on the next show about what we did with it and what mousse meat tastes like.
Maybe if you're lucky, you'll get a little.
Yeah. We'll freeze a little bit of it for you.
Take home.
But we have a few wines to tap into this afternoon, so we're going to take a short break and be right back. Thanks, Jack.
Thanks.
Awesome song choice.
Oh, thanks. That's just a good feeling song all around. You are listening to Unfiltered with your co-host, Aaron Fitzpatrick. Yes, Brian, we were back on. This is a quick break because we rambled a bit in segment one. So welcoming back to the...
Taste Some Wine.
Yeah, Taste Some Wine. Actually flipping a bit through the... previous weekend's Financial Times, which I didn't have a chance to read this weekend, but I was looking at Jance's column, which I look at every week, and she actually, speaking of Bali 2002, had given it a very favorable review a couple weeks back, just prior to New Year's. In the same section was the review of Roberta's. I don't know if you saw that, but there was a Nicholas Lander did a little piece on Roberta's in the Financial Times talking. It was his experience in New York, and it was Roberta's paralleled with Danielle. His two favorite eating experiences while he was, you know, grazing around town. So,
two obviously opposite ends of the spectrum.
Well, totally, like, yeah.
Both delicious.
Both delicious. And, you know, kudos to Carlos as well for just his being recognized for all the good stuff he's doing behind the line there. So, And then in her column today, or this past weekend, she talks a bit about how the Chinese have sort of turned their attention away from Bordeaux. You know, that's all in context. I'd say probably just glancing from Bordeaux to Burgundy. She's encouraging all those wine lovers of French wine to grab some Rhone before the Chinese do, because they're just sort of scooping up all the famed villages of France.
Well, typically Rhone was my first love in the wine business.
Me too, Bri.
Because I could afford it.
Yeah.
And it was
that was one of the first regions I ever traveled to. So that was sort
That's
of,
right,
yeah.
Yeah. And did we bond over? I think when you were a buyer, you bought my Rhone wines.
I did.
Oh,
yeah.
You're so sweet. You're so sweet.
Yeah, you went deep into the collection of Ras for me.
Yeah. Wow, that's let's try some Portuguese wine now.
No, that was at Bobo. You had a few of those. You had a few Hospice de Bone and
Yep, yeah. I went deep.
Deep, yeah. Yep. So, anyway, the 2010 vintage was a good one in Rhone. So,
well, for our first treat,
moving on.
Yeah,
moving onwards to the wine. Yes, what did you bring today?
We
what did
continue
you bring?
To talk about Rhone and other stuff,
right.
But I'm updating. You know, the wines that sometimes we send the studio here are. We drink them a lot because they're here, but I'm updating the new Vidigal wines from Portugal, which are from the Douro. This particular vintage is a Vino Tinto from Vidigal, but it's from Estremadura. Estremadura is now called Lisboa.
Uh-huh.
So some big news. The Portuguese have taken a wine DO that no one knew or understood and now made it Lisboa. So people are, oh, okay, I understand that Lisbon. And,
right.
And so this is right outside
Extremadura
of Lisbon.
Sounds very vague and vast.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm giving loose. Where's your glass, dear?
So is this one of the wines that Barter House carries?
It is. And
yeah.
It's not replacing because we used to have... in the studio here, and also we were working with an 05 vintage, and now we're on to the 07, 08 vintage, and the wine is still made in the Douro, but it's at the winery, but the fruit is all from Lisboa. So here we go, trying a red wine from Portugal. And I brought four wines today, one white and three reds. Three of the wines are all... essentially $10 wines.
Okay.
And one of the wines is essentially a $150 wine, because that's how we roll here, high and low.
Yes, that's how we roll everywhere, actually. Yeah.
Or MO.
Yep. I think that starting out, you might have selected one of the $10 wines. Is that possible?
I think that's how we warm up, my dear.
Yes, that's the case. So,
jammy.
Jammy, nice. It's a good pizza wine.
Pizza wine. That's why I bring it to Roberta's.
Yep. Yeah.
What do you think, Lou?
It's nice.
Right, exactly. See, that's all. So this is what it was. This is doing what it's meant to do, is to bring pleasure at a good price. And it's definitely a bistro wine. And so we have the Vidigal Vino Tinto 2007, and it's from Lisboa. And it's probably about $12 retail. So that would be something to be on the lookout for.
Well,
next wine, let's see. We have a Bordeaux, and this is another value wine.
Okay.
And I will let you guys
break it down.
Break it down. You can drink it blind.
All right.
Well, you know it's Bordeaux, so I guess there's only a handful of grapes it could be.
Yeah.
So what are you getting?
Black fruit, definitely black fruit. So I'm gonna side on the left bank with this one, more cab based than Merlot based. Some blackberries, some blueberries. I haven't even tried it yet, but I'm just smelling it at the moment.
So far, you're completely wrong, but go ahead.
All right, awesome. Yeah.
Nice.
Definitely a nice presence of oak, maybe over oak.
Yeah, potentially.
Yeah, potentially. So you got a lot of caramel, sort of vanilla notes on the the finish.
It's a Bordeaux Superior.
Uh-huh.
It's technically from the right bank.
Okay.
It's from Saint-Emilion, but not actually the appellation of Saint-Emilion, because it's a Bordeaux Superior. And it's predominantly Merlot and Cabernet Franc.
Mm-hmm.
So
bingo.
And, this is called Chateau Bertrand. And Chateau Bertrand is sort of interesting in that I think they're being sold to the Chinese. In fact, I was interviewed for an article by Ellen McCoy at Bloomberg, where she was trying to establish that the Chinese were trying to buy up, not just buy wines, but buy wineries. And the owner of the winery has owned it, I think, since for 400 years. It's been around for 400 years. It's in when the current owners, or the, I guess the... I should say the gatekeepers of the winery took over. It was a French gentleman who had married a Egyptian woman, and she's just a fabulous, obviously. And she, my relationship is with her. And so they took over the winery, and they said there was basically chickens and like goats walking through the chateau when they took over.
Cool.
And that it was this property that was, you know, 400 hectares of like just completely... You know, they just needed everything.
Lost in time,
it just,
sort of.
It just totally lost in time.
Yeah.
And they just couldn't believe they thought they had gotten good luck, but it was kind of like a Green Acres situation where they basically took over and they spent years fixing it up. And this wine represents some of the fruits of their labor. But again, a pretty simple, innocuous wine, I'd say.
Yeah, between the two, I like the Portugal one first better. What about you, Lou? Do you have a preference between the two?
We probably should try the Bordeaux first because the Portuguese one has more fruit.
Well, I think I agree with you. There's a little more happening in that than the Portuguese. In the Bordeaux.
Yeah.
The next one is it's called it's a Pinot Noir from Oregon, and it's the property's Dusky Goose.
I have no good Dusky Goose.
But this happens to be the single vineyard, the Rambouillet vineyard, and they only make a few cases of this wine. And I had one of these that was in my bag for Christmas that never got drank on Christmas, so I thought I'd bring it out here.
This is a little belated Christmas present for us then.
Thank you.
So.
Thank you.
Oregon Pinot, their winery's in Dundee Hills. And that's, you know, sort of right outside of Willamette Valley. And the actual town they're in is Newburgh. And this is, you know, Lynn Penarash is the winemaker of this wine. So
yeah.
The same winemakers of Penarash are making. And again, this is a single vineyard, so it's just, you know, it's probably a bit more robust and cared for. And
got great acidity. You know, it has that richness on the fruit, but then really kind of falls through on the palate with some bright acidity and sort of tang to it.
It's actually quite tasty.
Yeah, it is.
I'm a fan of Oregon Pinot Noirs, actually.
Yeah.
I think tang is not
good association.
No, I think it's fine. I'm not sure it's as complimentary as I think this wine is tasty.
Yes, well, that was just an initial sort of...
It's, you know, that's your Northern Long Island twang. Tang is your twang.
She just got off the LIE from her truck. Give her a minute.
Yeah. It's like she shows up in a pickup truck with, like, you know, jodhpurs and some in like 4-inch boots, heels, and
keep them guessing, babe. Yeah, it doesn't make any high sense. Lows, it's high fine lows, again. High lows. Lows, yes, thank you.
Highs and the lows.
Highs and lows.
It doesn't make.
But so what do you guys think of this one? I mean, I see Jack in the studio. He's like, he's chomping at the bit to get this this Oregon Pinot. So
I'm waiting for this white to chill down a little bit, you know.
Yeah, nice, nice.
It's elegant. It's nice.
This wine is spectacular. And
really good balance. It has a density of fruit, more like sort of raspberry, brambly qualities. But
this wine
light
is,
at the same time.
This wine is, we have this at the Four Seasons restaurant.
Cool.
And Julian there is a fan and pours it
by the glass or
not the Rambouillet, no. But they pour the base Dusky Goose. So.
Yeah.
And so we've have a good following from restaurateurs about this wine, and I think it's one of the sort of crowd favorites at retail. Where when you can find it, it's definitely a good buy. Mm-hmm, so be on the lookout for Dusky Goose from Dundee Hills, Oregon Pinots.
And you think this retails for about $100?
This one may be higher. It's a similar vineyard. It probably retails for around $100, yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing it.
Thank you.
Well, hey, this is our holiday show, part due. What do you think, Luz?
No, I like it. It is very nice. I appreciate Oregon Pinots.
Lou made some squab. And guinea hens for Christmas Day, and I could actually
Cornish game
hens,
and some lamb too.
Yeah, and some lamb, which I think this wine would have gone brilliantly with all three of those. Yeah. But you did have a Pinot Noir as well, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. My father-in-law was the buyer. I do not recall. Unfortunately, I was more focused on the food at that point. But yes, he did.
How did you make the game birds? Because a lot of times it can be fussy and. Did you debone any of them?
No, I didn't debone any of them. I split the Cornish game hen in half and sort of like laid them flat and roasted them on a hot pan with, I think I did apples with them. And then the squab I kept whole. They were tiny little birds, very cute. They were like under 2 pounds each. Mm. And I just kept glazing them with like an orange cider.
Oh, nice.
I stuffed those with apples that I had sort of marinated in the same glaze. They were quite tasty, I have to admit.
Mm-hmm. That was a meat hook purchase.
Yeah.
That's
always the only place to buy meat, but yes.
That's nice. Yeah. That's nice. Well, this is really, I'm so glad we got to see. We don't have a guest and we're just kind of rambling, but this is actually one of my favorite shows.
Well, you're just going to miss us because you're going to be gone next week. So can you, do you know your itinerary yet for the trip? Are you going with Wines of Austria? Or?
Actually, I'm going to meet the exporter, Klaus, who's actually been on the show.
Sure, yeah.
And I'm meeting him in Munich.
Anton Bauer.
Yeah. I'm flying to Munich from Newark. And we're going to do a little Oktoberfest in January.
Okay.
So get a little nice. And then we're going to meet, we'll go to Hillinger and we're going to meet up with those guys. And I've 2 or 3 days to see all our producers and then fly out of Vienna. And so spend a night in Vienna.
Okay.
And then fly out of Vienna the next day back into JFK. So, you know, pretty quick hit, 4 days, but like 2 of those days I'm essentially traveling.
Yeah.
So it's basically to
reconnect
the,
yeah.
and taste the new vintages, see what's in tank.
Excellent.
Make my mark on what I want, to have some input on the blends, and pick the volume that we're going to do based on what I taste.
Excellent.
So if I think we're going to have a good vintage. I think there's a good vintage for 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to try to isolate which wines we take to the U.S. So cool. It's a good buying trip.
Excellent. Well, bon voyage in advance, and we'll hash out about Moose when you return.
I'd love it. Well, yeah. Anyway, this ends a very mellow and good episode of Unfiltered. And thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.